Welcome to our podcast, Land and People, where we interview people with ancestral or professional ties to the land. I'm Melissa Kamara. I'm a conservationist and artist here on Hawaii Island.
And I'm Clay Trawernick, an extension faculty at the University of Hawaii at Manoa in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Management. And as a caveat, none of the views or opinions expressed here reflect those of our employer or funders. Just like to create a space that people can share their thoughts, share their perspectives. If you haven't yet, please rate and review. We love getting feedback and it helps other people find the podcast, or so we're told.
It does. And share this podcast too with people you know. It would be great. We always want folks who are interested to know about this work that we're doing.
Yeah. And thanks so far. Just thanks for all the feedback we've
gotten.
Yeah. It's really
mahalo,
meaningful.
You guys.
Yeah.
We wouldn't have a podcast without you, our listeners. So we do want to say thank you for that. As you know, we've been talking to artists and historians and language people, and our next guest is really all of those things. His name is Dr. Kalihua Krug. He is a traditional kakao or tattoo artist. He's also a school principal of Kawaihona Oka Na'awao School, which is out in Nanakuli on West Oahu. He's also an incredible musician with an amazing falsetto voice. He's an activist. He's just been an advocate for land and indigenous philosophy.
We've been talking about connections to place really throughout this podcast, and think Kalihua has just got this amazing way to articulate that journey of like, how do you get there? What are the barriers, right, that are like in our way to reconnect, to like rebuild those connections? And that was a lot of what we talk about in this interview.
We do get into Hawaiian values, Hawaiian ethics, as we did with Hanna Springer a few episodes ago, and we do so with Kalihua. It's really incredible. And the thing I'm taking away from his interview is something I wish I'd actually asked him about, which is the Hawaiian proverb Makahana Kaike, in which one learns by doing.
Right, the work.
Doing the work.
Honestly, we journey all as individuals, and there's all these socioeconomic barriers to connecting to the land. I mean, this is sort of what we're circling around in this podcast. And we kind of dive into that a little bit, but I think the most sort of admirable thing I find with Kalihua is that his sort of, you can see it so genuinely in the work that he does, like through the language work and through the work with the students at his school. He's literally creating the space that's facilitating their journey. Kind of a beautiful thing to see that someone embody that through their work.
And so with that, here's our next guest, Dr. Kalihua Krug of Kawaihona o Kana'awao. Po mahalo nui for meeting with us.
Oh, aye. No aole pilikia.
I've been admiring like all that you've been doing and all everything that you've been talking about. And I think I told you in maybe in a direct message that we have been, Clay and I, in our podcast, Land and People, we've been all this season talking to folks on Maui, cultural practitioners, biologists, land people, because of the fires and everything going on. And now we're kind of switching a little bit to folks who are educators and artists to try to make sense of it, right?
Yeah.
So moving away a little bit from like the impacts of that to looking towards like wisdom and what folks can and offer on a perspective of that. So that's sort of why we contacted you.
Mahalo.
Well, yeah, and you and others just in the last couple of interviews have been in these places that have been damaged and impacted.
Mm-hmm.
Fire and otherwise, right? We can maybe talk a little bit about that.
Yeah.
Clay, do you want to ask the first question?
Yeah, I do. And I would just add to that the context. I think it's so cool, like the work that you're doing with the education side. And because we think about the changes that need to happen. And I was mentioning earlier, we were on that panel together that Ke Fukuda organized for that summer program. And it was so funny because I'm like, how deep are we going to go on this?
Yeah, then
you were first and you were just like right into it, you know, you're just like right. And I was like, oh, okay, this is cool.
Oh, man.
What were you guys like right into off the bat? Because you two have met each other before.
It was just that one time. And she brought us together for... basically did these different themes for this kind of summer program where the students from Waianae and Nanakuli do these projects related to these themes. And so I think it was water was one that you were there to speak about. I don't know if you ended up doing more work with them or and I was fire.
Okay.
Just more consulting, I think.
Yeah, you know, it was the same. Sending
them down little directions to figure out what the kids wanted to do with their programming.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's, anyway, the context and thinking about just like that as an example, but how much work we need to do. And it's like these guys that are coming up.
Yep.
That's why I was like pretty excited about the opportunity and her idea to like reach out.
Well, man, that's kind of been, I mean, that's the decision-making road that I've been on, is you kind of put the nose to the ground and sniff out the track of what's the positionality of greatest efficacy to make those changes that we talk about, you know?
And
I've had opportunity to work at the UH and working in the superintendent's office at the DOE, and I think this role right here is actually the most effective place to be, because you can actually have children watch you enact the behaviors that you're hoping from them. Right. You're not just at this systemic level puppet master, hoping that everybody understands what it is that you want from them in the system, at all levels of the system. Not saying that anything in the system is ineffective, but I have tried to travel through the system to figure out where right now in this space and time. And I think being a principal is that's ground zero, and ground zero is where we can make build the programming and build the examples that become templates and models for systems to utilize in the future.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, maybe related to that, just some place to start is, do you have any experience, or what experience kind of growing up, was this ever in your line of sight, like be within education or, you know, just?
I mean, both my parents are educators. So my mom was a second grade teacher. My dad was a school counselor.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But my dad was like a farmer, kind of a cowboy hunter from Montana.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a lot of access to nature when we would travel up there. And then, you know, my mom, her family's from Molokai, but raised up here in Nanakuli.
Yeah.
And so had access to, fishermen in my family. I'm not that great as those guys, but, you know, my grandmother was a part of a Hawaiian cultural church that was kind of a pretty decent blend of Christianity and Hawaiian indigenous values and beliefs. So a lot of exposure in my life to a lot of different things that, you know, fishermen create fishermen.
Right.
And so my parents being teachers, I couldn't resist becoming everything that I heard at the dinner table. And I mean, I was already thinking through some of the things that I contemplate still to today at the dinner table. Yeah.
Can you give us an example?
Standardized testing. That's the greatest example and it's really, you know, funny yet awkward, because, you know, my father was their testing coordinator at his school, and he was a school counselor, and he started these conversations at the dinner table about norm reference testing and the punitive outcomes that are attached to funding and how you know, just psychometrics in general aren't there to punish. They're not there to inform funders. They're there to actually take the snapshot and create these repositories of data over time so that you can actually make adjustments to curriculum.
Right.
Like, it's supposed to drive curriculum.
Right,
it's not
supposed
to drive money. It's not supposed to drive punishment like
we're
misusing it. So that was the start of it.
Interesting.
And so that was, I remember that clearly, because he would go on and on and on. And when I was at UH, we actually took in the first state grant that was given to Hawaiian language immersion folks to build our own standardized tests.
Right.
Mm. But I think it was serendipitous maybe that I would take in and be the principal investigator of that moment in time with the conversations you know, that my dad had, because losing yourself was a big part of the mantra that we carried, is that this isn't Hawaiian.
Right.
But this is something that can take us off on the trajectory towards authentic Hawaiian indigenous assessments. And so not losing yourself in the road was a big part of that conversation.
Was at least their agreement, I mean, this is getting away from like you, maybe so much as like that effort, but was there agreement in the need to do it versus, or was it pretty controversial? Like, is this something we even should be working on?
Definitely something it's constantly controversial till today. But I think at that moment in time, there was an advocacy organization called the Akaoleo that was unified. I mean, this is like 90 members from all immersion schools, parents, teachers, principals. I mean, everybody was unified and advocating for not being assessed in English.
Yeah, that makes so much sense.
Becoming disjointed from the language medium and the language of assessment was something that folks just couldn't get over.
Yeah.
So anything beyond that, the scope of that contemplation, which is where I think your question was headed, you know, that was, I think, further to come now. I still believe that you build these comparative systems to not just show a more truer picture of data, but you show that you have capacity to engage at the levels that people think we can't engage at. So we prove the narrative wrong.
Yeah.
Right. So there's multiple positive points of it. However, that's not the end game.
It's kind of like using the system against it. It's like proving your point through it.
That assessment got federal approval, first indigenous language assessment approved by the federal government. And so that's definitely a consciousness shift.
But when you were young thinking through this, I mean, I'm sure you weren't thinking like that, well, that's going to be my PhD later.
No.
You're probably like, and I heard this from Kamalka, your interview with Kamalka Diaz about having that gut punch of disconnect.
Yeah.
And so I imagine that being a teacher and connecting with the kids, maybe I'm putting words in your mouth, but it's a suturing of
absolutely
what you didn't have or what others didn't have, and giving them that. And I'd love to know just how that's affected you personally and professionally, you know, like if you saw that at a young age, like that's what I want to do, or was it a process of discovery of like, I know I'm missing something, I've got to go figure that out, and then now I need to share it.
Definitely those questions of identity were the driving force in my childhood to send me to search for, I mean, because I think right now I love reading about psychology and philosophy. I mean, those things I feel are innate, are natural to me.
Yeah, the wonder.
Working towards a space of wisdom is something my mind wants to do, you know, whatever the trajectory may be. I have some like written reports from high school and intermediate where I was contemplating being in a family that was looks Native Hawaiian and being like, you know, the white sheep of the family. You know what I mean?
Or
me and my sister kind of being the fair-skinned members of the that ohana. And nobody really treated us differently. So it wasn't a matter of treatment. It was just a matter of observation and how one searches for self. And I think I embarked on that pretty young, and I think it shaped my entire life, you know?
So the
things that I'm doing today, I can probably tie every decision I've made to me trying to tether back to identity.
And it's so clear, given your the art forms.
Yes.
And I think we asked this in our questions about being close to Kupuna and trying to, I mean, I've come across, and I mean, truly I'm like a surface student on this, but you seem to really be seeking to know what your ancestors went through physically and otherwise through the art form of tattoo. I would love to hear more, a little bit more about that, how you came to that for yourself, and also you do that for others, and maybe what you have learned, what you feel you want, you could share with us about what you have learned through that.
I mean, honestly, my road starts off because skin color and facial, how I look, doesn't mark the expression of Hawaiianness that I feel like I represented as a part of my identity. Like how I saw myself inside wasn't what I saw in the mirror. And so you search for markings. And that was the, you know, it's no more complex than that. You know, my features drove me to understand that I need something else there in place to be able to exemplify and manifest in a physical form my identity.
What's
and
inside?
So I started off with machine tattoos, a few little ones, and then with that UH, I got an opportunity to meet Keonea Nunes, got a hold of him, and I was already kind of studying, and, you know, I don't know what he heard when I spoke or when we had conversations, but he offered me at a very young age to be part of a class to learn this practice. And through that practice, I got to manifest physically my identity. But what I went through at that space is that you actually get pulled through higher vibrations of comfort. That every step of the way towards kupuna, you know, and I put air quotes up there, but but whatever that search entails, that the closer and closer you get to them, the more and more comfort that you actually feel belonging to place, that it's no longer about me anymore. Like, I think my search for identity was egotistical to a point, and I didn't know any better, you know.
Yeah, of course. I think we all probably, you kind of all have to start
somewhere.
Many of us, at least.
But that's where I get back to, like, you know, being able to travel into, I think, the rungs of wisdom that the kupuna have kind of laid out in front of us is more moving away from the self and understanding that the cultural beliefs had a greater impact on our world, the larger collective, that we weren't these individuals that tethered to each other. We were actually like these fractions of a greater one, of a greater whole.
It's almost like through time.
Through time.
Not just the space now.
And so the more and more you draw nearer to kupuna, the more clear it becomes that they weren't just deciding about things that were for human benefit. They were deciding, like, everything that they did, their ethic, the morals that they attached to decision making, mm-hmm. everything was in tune with the betterment of the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, that they didn't just, they knew that they couldn't just live based upon what they needed or what they wanted, right. that there was something greater there. And I would say that, like, that's why the animistic spirituality that they employed, you know, solidified and codified that in the soul of everybody.
Do you think, like, I mean, it's one thing to read, and it's a whole, and read about it and intellectualize it in an abstract mm-hmm. way, right? And mm-hmm. as a visual artist, like, and having, like, dive deep into genealogy and, like, mm-hmm. looked at the archives for the exact same reason what you're talking about. It's another thing to physically go through that as a physical practice for me mm-hmm. in the studio for you. Yep. Same thing. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like you through learning Olelo Hawaii tattooing that it became embedded in a way that reading about it in an abstract way.
Yeah, or couldn't. I was going to ask in a really similar vein, like, is it, because it's like knowledge through practice, like the catchphrase, right?
So yeah.
It's like a process beyond just, I got there.
Well, it's definitely a reconditioning.
Mm-hmm.
And I see it, you know, that's the word I term, because that's kind of what we're doing here.
Mm-hmm.
Not reconditioning through, because I think for me, reconditioning more symbolizes that there's something established or in place, and I had to kind of revamp that,
mm-hmm.
right. you know. The reconditioning that takes place at a younger age is more collective reconditioning, and has greater impact, you know, than 0 to 8. And
you have a space here that you can create, mm-hmm. which is quite different from, I mean, what do you get as an adult?
I can share, like, tattooing kakao as my children were younger. Being for them, I think I saw the greatest impact, because they their level of belief in the spirit part of the world,
mm-hmm.
You know, that the world has its own life, its consciousness, and that mm-hmm. you can interact in it. Kakao was kind of like the enforcer, you know. I say that in a really tongue-in-cheek kind of way.
Yeah.
But there was always this experience that you were working towards,
mm-hmm.
that you're working towards. I get to show my beliefs. I get to show my ancestors. I get to show my system of spiritual organization that I'm willing to do that for you.
Yeah.
Right.
And in turn, that indirectly, when you give, I want to say sacrifice in that way. The word is molia in Hawaiian. But when you actually lie down and give that, the courage that it takes, the preparedness that it takes as a person or as a researcher, and knowing your family,
mm-hmm.
The responsibilities that you've had to uphold in your family, just to get to that point, are so immense that it's like, you know, it's just the sprinkles on the cake, but the cake is a big, delicious chocolate cake, you know? and the tattoo just becomes the sprinkle on the end.
Right.
Being a influential part of their upbringing, it codified. Like what I was saying is that just having those beliefs in that space, as I believe, like a voyager taking a boat out onto the open ocean and not seeing land anymore. I would figure Olapa dancing at the edge of Kilauea as it erupts like that.
Right.
Those are the events, I think, that codify these belief structures, and the belief structures are established to ensure humans interact properly with the natural mm-hmm. world.
Right, and that moment, it totally makes so much sense, because that moment really captures, like, all that preparedness, like moving towards that space, and you can't, it's not just the act of it or what you're saying, like the sprinkles that come out at the end. It's the whole process. I had a, like, related question about, and maybe this is tied into kakao as well, but you've talked, again, I think from the interview I probably caught, was it Keep It Aloha, but you know, about the openness, if you see the Hawaiian knowledge, right, as a body of knowledge, and I love how you frame it as kind of this, it's like the science, right? It's like how we coexist, how we persist, thrive, really.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious, in thinking through the context of kakao, the parts of it, are there parts of it that are open and other parts that kind of need to be protected in that sense?
Yeah.
So it's like open as far as, like, we all can learn some of these practices that we need to, you know, take lessons, versus other parts of it that maybe you keep closed.
Well, part of protecting cultural knowledge, for me, this is about like these behaviors we enact.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So when you protect something, you exemplify sanctity. And so if everything is what we call Noah, if everything is open to everybody, then there's really nothing sacred.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, so at the lower levels of land, the vow Kanaka, everybody mm-hmm. is okay. But as you get up into the vow Akua, you have a vow Akua mm-hmm. to make sure the vow Kanaka is established.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you can make it up there and you got the stamina and the muscles, then you can get up into the vow Akua.
Right.
But should you? You
yeah.
know, a lot of people might be able to pick up the tools and you know, tattoo circles around me, but should they?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it's there's more to it than that. Is that it's almost like the yin and yang established or embedded within the traditions.
Mm-hmm.
Is that for sanctity to exist, it must exist.
Yeah.
Like it's got to be manifested somehow, and people have got to see it. Because if not, it has no magic.
Right,
it has no
right,
influence.
Right.
It has no depth. It has no meaning.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And there's no like work towards.
So we're not hiding
yeah.
it. Like yeah. it's not hiding it. Like yeah. this is mine. You gotta have it. You know. This is like
yeah.
I have to hide something.
Right.
Because something has to be magical.
Yeah.
But there are things that are on the internet. So
right.
if you want to go yeah. look at them, they're there.
Right, and it's all like contextualized, right? So what lessons you take, right? So much depend on the teacher, the mentors you
yeah.
have.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I'd love to hear more about, I heard you say triangulation when you were talking mm-hmm. to Kamaka,
yeah.
you know, and about, okay, let's research this. Let's,
yeah.
let's people want to say this or that. Let's like have multiple sources of information
yes.
if we're
yes.
saying something. And then there's your own personal interpretation, mm-hmm. which you are quite clear about saying, like, this is just what I think and what I'm going to do on me and what I might try on my family. And
yeah.
I love, and I we hear that a little bit with other cultural practitioners about like breaking from tradition and like
yeah.
saying, hey, you know, actually I'm going to try something new, push it a little bit. Do you have any thoughts about that and like where you feel you can experiment and where you feel like, oh no, we should always be going back to multiple sources for knowledge, you
yeah
know?
Well if they're there, you know, I mean,
right.
I think what actually got me to that understanding is that when you walk through the path of research,
mm-hmm.
it's really apparent quickly that there's not
a lot missing.
There's not a lot there.
Yeah,
I mean, there's quite a bit that you can search through,
mm-hmm.
but I still try to remind some researchers is that when you're reading a figurative language, you cannot interpret and infer literal.
Right. Yeah.
Which right. means that yeah. you've got to dig into. So if the researcher in of his or herself does not enact those traditions, I always use the word enact, enact the traditional
yeah.
behavior.
Yeah.
If you yourself are not walking through
yeah.
trying engage with that, you don't have, I'll say, the philosophical foundation
yeah.
necessary to interpret what's actually being written
right.
or chanted.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That your walk
yeah.
informs
mm-hmm.
through commitment, again, through all the things I said before, courage
yeah.
and the
yeah.
overcoming of fear and being ostracized in your families and community. Like you pay for it.
Yeah.
Walking that traditional walk is not easy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so when you walk through that walk, experience the walk, you experience talking, you know, to
yeah.
Akua.
Yeah.
You experience the awe you feel or the actual cleanliness you feel walking out of the ocean.
Right.
You gotta feel that.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not it's a delusion or not.
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter yeah. because if you can feel that, then that's what is actually gonna start informing the figurative language use so that we're not making these. And this is really, I argued this like 6 months ago.
Yeah.
And it's hard to argue with someone to say, yes, the words say that literally.
Yeah.
But look at all the examples in that time frame
mm-hmm.
that point to the contrary.
Exactly.
Right.
And you've got to know that.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
and talk about it. Because it's not just, oh, but it said.
Right.
I was like,
yeah.
right, but it said, but look at this. What kind of researcher are you
yeah,
if you
yeah.
avoid all of this?
Or,
you can't avoid it.
We were just talking with Hannah Springer on Big Island, and they're like talking about these place and stories that connect to the place, and
yeah.
you literally learn it walking through
yeah.
the landscape. So it's not even like that's physical, literally, you know, through that space that embodies all of that
yeah.
as well. And so you're just like compared to someone sitting in a library.
Yeah.
You know, trying to figure this out.
I think trying to get back to your original question. Sorry. But I do believe that the decisions that we make, personal ones, are for items that we have not encountered the information yet.
Yeah. Mm.
Examples is like this tattoo on my mouth.
Mm-hmm.
It's a story told to my teacher. And you know, many people kind of chalk it off as, oh, that's not Hawaiian, that's Marquesan. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, that triggers the, well, we have migrations from the Marquesas.
Right.
You know, I mean,
right.
Those are actually documented.
Right. Yeah.
And so what do we do with that?
Right.
Because now you're talking about ethnocentrism and that's how people identify to Hawaiianness, and it's my culture and no one else can be it.
Right.
Like, you know, cutting these lines of delineation between what, insofar as I can see, our family members.
Yeah.
I'm so glad you bring that up, because that's something that Clay and I have talked about a bit, because he's lived in Micronesia. Anyway, I don't know if you want to say anything about that, Clay, but...
Well, just that perspective on how much is shared, right? But as far as cultural practices, knowledge, like the same ways of using certain plants, I mean, that's really my experience with it. And then... You know, when they come to this is going to get into so many other things, but when they come here, like I say, Micronesian emigrates and comes to this place, and it's not the cultural differences so much as like socioeconomic structures that kind of create then this separation. And it's so artificial, and I just can't keep from thinking, like, if people met in that space and just like we're able to see how much they have in common, that it would just, it's like
unified.
These barriers should just be like,
there should be no barriers,
you know? And I
most of those responses, I'll say, are framed by colonization.
Yeah, 100%.
Definitely.
I mean, you can't, I mean, I don't know how you get away from that, because these are like, and I call it like cultural poverty.
Yeah.
So when you are in a status of cultural poverty, you hold everything you got.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which for most people ain't much.
Yeah.
But you hold it all, and then you treat it, you know, you hide it.
Yeah.
And then you choose the, you know, I mean, you're really, really strict and kind of stingy in the way that you share it out.
Mm-hmm.
Because if that gets exploited, or if that's no longer just yours, then you in and of yourself lose your individual value.
Yeah, it makes some total sense.
When the language is gone, the culture is gone, the religion is gone, and you got this kick-ass emu practice, you know?
Right.
You're gonna guard that with your life.
Totally.
Because once that's gone, or somebody misappropriates it and writes a book about it and doesn't quote you or whatever, you disappear.
Yeah.
And that's what I think the fear is, that just we're watching ourselves in essence disappear. Like the skin color on my body is disappearing. You know, the level of melanin in my blood's
disappearing. And it pushes you back to that individualism that you're like telling us about this journey to like overcome. And all of a sudden everything around you is like pushing it right back at you.
And I mean, but I always use that as like, you're looking at this photo of yourself disappearing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it gets scary. You know, you're like, holy shit, I'm
isn't it Back to the Future?
I'm almost gone.
Yeah.
it's scary to, because it's about, it's existential. You know, so you're thinking, I'm not going to exist.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, for real.
You know? And so, I mean, I think that, but that cultural poverty guides us to that point. But, you know, in that space of poverty, it's like, we also have to understand that because we're that, we're sharing a potential gold mine of answers for all humans here to save our islands. Like, you know, when we hold our culture to ourselves and not give it to everybody, that's actually like the golden ticket.
Totally.
That the conglomeration of all that we know could help us rebuild ecological stability in our islands. But we hide.
Yeah.
You know, we don't talk about certain things with certain people, and generally, like, you know, in that other podcast, what I'm trying to say is that see beyond yourself for everybody. Mm-hmm. You know, think of those birds. I know it's corny, but see beyond yourself and acknowledge the plants, the birds, the fish, that are leaving our world.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, and maybe because plenty, you know, evolutionary biologists will always say, look, well, evolution's still going, and we're still gonna, speciation is still on the road, so don't worry about them leaving, because new ones will come. And I'm like, what?
Not in our lifetime. Yeah.
Are you really? I mean, is that really how we're gonna go into our future?
No,
but then that's also just ignoring the root cause of, you know, cultural poverty is linked to economic poverty ultimately.
Yep.
And
yep.
It reminds me, I'm like, there's two ways I'd like to go, but one question I had for you, I've been thinking about, is framing it like cultural poverty might be a way to explain it. I'm just curious about how you have these kids, and you've described this like really beautiful opportunity you have here, and the space that you're really creating to allow these kids to connect to this place. And I'm curious, at what point And maybe it's not here, but do you start inserting that political education, like to start allowing them? I mean, maybe it's innate through the connection to place, but I'm just curious if that's...
So definitely our middle school, man.
Yeah.
I mean, we take them to the march, and we took them to the Onipa'a march this last, a couple weeks ago, I think.
Yeah, it was just last week.
Yeah, something like that. When I look across our middle schoolers, they're not all ethnically Hawaiian.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But you can see folks that are not ethnically Hawaiian in the front row charging the chants.
Yeah.
Like and I think it's because they start to get the sense of that not they did something wrong, but something's wrong.
Right.
You know, I think that's part of our duty, everyone's duty, you know, to figure out and feel when something's wrong, because I think it starts there.
Yeah.
Everybody can kind of feel something's wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and the kids know, like, you know, over here, we can ask them, it's like, there's pu'eo up there. There should be pu'eo.
Right.
Anybody see pu'eo? Oh, I see him at night. No. Hawaiian pu'eo are diurnal.
Yeah, they're, you know, that's the
they fly now. In the day in flocks. Yeah. It's like, have you seen a flock of pu'eo during the day? And they're like, no. And you ask them those questions, the right answer arrives so instantaneously.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, what should we do? Oh, we got to help them.
Right.
You know, should we keep developing over their nest and their land? Yeah. No, absolutely no. Why would we do that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Why would we even think
they
about
know
that?
What to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But somehow we train them out of that.
Right.
Yeah.
And I mean, I have some ideas how, but I don't want to talk about it. But they learn
yeah.
not to see that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The reason I ask is that I see it even at the college level, you know, because I'm in the natural sciences and I don't teach a lot of classes. Often when you're interacting with students, even at that level, they're often not, it's taught as if it's disconnected from politics and society and culture. And so you lose those tools. You become so technical that you actually, you know, you're not learning history. Like, it's that fundamental. And all right, how far do we need to back up here? And, you know, and that's what I was joking before when we were on this panel, and it's, you know, if you want to talk about fire and water, it's the same conversation. It's how deep do you want to like understand this root cause? Because it is fundamentally about, starts with colonization, really, right? And what that's kind of left us. But
he's giving a lot of interviews about that to different media outlets related to the fire.
Because people want to understand why, just like you were saying with the kids, like it's not complicated once you learn like what happened and like what we choose to do with these lands. And why it looks the way it does, why there's no pu'eo, you can't understand it without historical understanding.
Well, why I enjoy this age range is because I think most of us decide based upon like these experiential mantras that we've encountered.
Mm-hmm.
And we have these phrases or core beliefs and core values that come through maybe like the Bible or you know, whatever spiritual dialogue. Like, we have these things, like blood is thicker than water.
Right.
You know, I mean, we have mantras like that that teach us from young. It's like, screw all you guys, I'm taking care of my own.
Yeah.
And that's a thing. It becomes normalized to say like, oh, I've done all of these things for the sake of my children.
Yeah.
You know, and I always tell them, like, what about the bird children, you know, or the whale children?
Yeah. I mean,
we can carry the mantra, but we gotta, you know, edit it a little bit.
Yeah.
And kind of, and frame it that, being a part of the ecological structures, the hierarchies in these scientific systems that govern the planet, there are laws, there are rules.
Yeah.
And we cannot break them, and we have to walk with fidelity through those laws.
Yeah.
And these mantras disallow that, you know, because we're like, oh, we keep having all these kids and this population. It's just when you compare how much food is necessary, like, you build these mantras of hunger and starvation, more food equals more people. And you keep making more food, thinking that you're going to conquer starvation, and you never do.
Right.
You just increase population, and we're not even talking about that. Like, climate change and the sciences.
Right.
You got enough people on the contrary side to say it's not even a real thing. It's like, all right. Wow. I mean, I don't even know where to go for that. You can't even have the conversation.
Right, if you can't agree on the basics.
If you can't agree on the basics.
Yeah, I mean,
that's something that exists.
You can kind of definitely be in a bubble at a university, for example, and not, you know, but I also think that there's opportunities and I just keep thinking about like childhood education where you know, show them how to relate to plants, you know, and that simple act you can kind of, like you were saying earlier, not recondition. You had a better word for it, I think, but it was just that simple thing is rooting someone into what does matter.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not it's going to overcome climate change, that's like a bigger question. But
I think it's just more about our ethics deter us from erring to the conservative.
Yeah.
You know, like, because mm-hmm. that's an easy one.
Yeah.
It's like, well, maybe, can you agree? Maybe climate's changing faster than it did naturally. Because maybe.
Yeah.
Because if it's just maybe, then we all can rally around and say, yeah, you know what?
Yeah.
Let's err to the conservative for our children.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
And stop doing some of this shit.
Right. Right. You know? Totally. Totally.
Or we don't do that.
Do things on the landscape that we know would make it better. It would make it safer for the community, or would provide more food locally. I mean, there's so many things. I think the other thing that we sort of get stuck in, obviously, is the trap that it's like, who's going to pay for it, right? Like, we don't equate the, like, human health benefits.
You know? Existential benefits.
The dollar signs on that are like, well.
You know, I just traveled to Las Vegas, and the Sphere had this show inside. So we bought tickets, went inside, watched the show, and it was really about, I was just shocked, because it's about the planet and speciation, and how, you know, how the world came from, and 13.8 billion years ago. And we get to the end, and there was a rocket sent to, like, Mars to terraform.
Oh, my God.
Oh, man.
That was the end of the story. That's, and me and my kids are sitting there like,
huh? Bleak.
What just happened? Yeah. What? I mean, I thought we were going in such a great direction. And the thing just turned.
Yeah, that's kicked us in, like, you know. Put the blinders up.
I know.
I was like, what, we can't, no.
Yeah, no. Oh my gosh, I work in ecological restoration. Like, we're not terraforming Mars.
No.
but I mean, there was like, you know, 400, 500 people in there with like four or five shows a day, and we're all watching that.
Nonsense.
I was like, that's all we got.
That's all we
people
got.
People clapped at the end.
Oh really?
And they're like, oh, man. I was like, no, stop this. Are you crazy? Yeah. You know,
oh my gosh. But,
yeah, that's bonkers.
It is.
And that's what I think we were talking about, like social media and just being able to talk to people and engage with people.
Right.
Is that I believe intelligent people have the ability to talk about both sides.
Mm-hmm.
That you can always kind of steel man what your perspective is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it strengthens your beliefs and your values, but it also provides a space of empathy to attach to other people.
Right.
Because even in this field, I can understand where they're coming from.
Mm-hmm.
If climate change happened all the time, which I understand it did throughout the, you know,
a deeper history,
the years, like it, that maybe we're overly concerned about nothing.
Wow.
Well, yeah. I can understand that, but the data is overwhelming, and you know, we unfortunately live in the extinction capital of the world multiple years in a row,
you know.
And how do you, even though you can steel man and understand it, I can't support it.
Yeah.
You know, I can't with that much information.
Yeah.
Just kind of standing on my front porch.
Yeah. Or just you still letting people be homeless on the beaches, right? I mean, so regardless of like climate change, you know, can we get back to the things that would locally be done? Again, talking about community safety and fire is really an obvious one, but like water quality is like the fundamental. If we need to be doing things to that would allow us, like, if it's happening, you know what I mean? Like, I'm not trying to make the argument, it's not obviously, but if it is happening, there are these things clearly we need to do that will make all of us better off, right?
You know?
Take care of our water, take care of our land.
Yeah.
If there's actually jet fuel in the pipe, in the water, then we probably sure should.
We do want to get to that because we have been focusing on all these environmental situations. Yep. Mm-hmm. And you've been so active in Red Hill. You live here in Waianae.
Yeah.
My family's from here too, and with the fires and all, I mean, it's ongoing. Clay, you often talk about on the show, three valleys burning at once. When was that? 2018.
2018. That was the last big one here.
How have these catastrophes like affected you personally and your family? And
well, I think, you know, for most of my life, I've just been advocating for language and like indigenous worldview. You know, but Mauna Kea kind of shed a light that I never contemplated before, and I know many folks have. So I'm definitely behind on those proverbial times when it comes to advocacy of land. But it really mirrored for me something that was apparent in the advocacy for language and culture, which is that things are actually disappearing. Like I raise our children in Aloha Hawaii through the, you know, 0 to 8, that zone of proximal development. thinking about establishing a worldview, thinking about establishing a native language thought, those types of things, because you can quantify in a population the amount of kupuna who speak that language. Yeah. Like you can quantify it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, then there's a lot of research on if there are low percentages of people who speak a language, the potential of the language authentically surviving drops exponentially. Right. Mm-hmm. Looking at land, it's the same damn thing. And I really wasn't, you know, because I was so, you know, pigeonholed into language and culture and education, those spaces that I never really looked up and said, holy cow.
Right.
Like the environment's falling apart while I'm over here, you know, egotistically trying to fix something human. and even though I'm not going to stop that, I am going to look up and look around. So Mauna Kea kind of brought that. This idea of development, where we develop, why are things okay and not okay, and even the argumentation that, well, you know, it's not sacred because it's like, when somebody tries to do that, not only is that hyper manipulative,
right?
You know, because it's basically gaslighting an entire culture,
right?
But you're taking away from the disappearing person in the picture. Mm-hmm. You're taking another arm away,
right?
By taking away those manifestations of sanctity that help to build and delineate the hierarchies of our existence, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so just looking at development in the Vawakua, whether or not, how many, there's like, oh, not too many people live there, and there were, you know, there's all these.
There's already telescopes.
Yeah, there's already telescopes, but all of that, right?
Mm-hmm.
But just the mantra, the danger of that is that if we succumb to that mantra, then there's no end.
Yeah.
There's no end to development. There's no end to commodification of land and natural resources. There's no end to pollution.
Right.
I mean, if you think of the people who built the Red Hill tanks, they had no idea that this is going to happen.
Yeah.
Because I feel like on the majority, that they were all good people. Like they were,
right.
They succumbed to the mantras that we're built around national defense and the potential of a war, and we got to America.
Yeah, but I mean, on the ground, it was probably like engineering question. I mean, it, you know, whatever the motivations, you can start to get into the moral question about that. But as far as like, you know, it wasn't the intention to poison water.
But I don't think that they were bad people doing a really, really nasty thing to the environment and people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I mean, I think in that space and entering into Mauna Kea and just really, again, when you walk through it, you end up just thinking certain things that you wouldn't have thought about if you didn't do that or walk through it, which is kind of everything, Tatooine, and you know, it's kind of everything.
Right.
You got to walk through it to feel it and to give your mind its greatest chance, opportunity to think certain ways from our tradition or just a different worldview. But that's how it was an easy transition over to water and water advocacy, and really trying to bring cultural advocacy to the forefront to be able to provide greater recognition and, you know, just the notoriety of the problem, just being able to put it out into the public that do whatever you're going to do, but this is happening.
This is happening.
It's been happening for a long time.
Yeah.
I haven't been paying attention. Now I am. Oh my God, I'm terrified. You know,
right.
And just really be able to say that and utilize culture as the point.
Right.
You know, the point of advocacy.
Right.
And look what happened. I mean, that was truly a bottom-up movement because like the leaders knew for a long time, frankly, that this was going on. Right. I mean, it really took like the marches and the community.
Yeah.
Insistence and advocacy for that thing to get done.
I think it was effective because it hit a different population.
Yeah, at the outset, right?
Yeah,
right.
It actually, you know, and many of them, honestly, were, you know, Caucasian. So you had
the military base.
You had the Asians.
Yeah.
You know, from the water protectors that were already kind of you had Hawaiians. You had us all standing there like, what the hell is going on? You know, I mean, basically pulling the pants off of the American government in that in that moment, and asking them, it's like, you know,
what's happened?
What's happening? Where are we going from here? How did this happen?
I mean, in the same way, it's like Lahaina too. It hit so many, you know, the struggles for water in there have been decades in the making, and then Lahaina happened, and it's like, see, I'm putting words in people's mouths, but it's more like we've been talking about this for a really long time.
It's connected to the same.
It's connected to the same struggles for water and farmlands and all of that out there. And here's what happened. Here's the outcome, you know, of many different things, including the lack of water.
And it's a worldview problem.
Yeah.
It's just it's just a worldview problem. Yeah. The ideological underpinnings that guide all of our decisions, especially lawmakers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's sad because, I mean, I'm trying my best. Changing all the little, changing the worldview of the little lawmakers in training.
Yeah. That's totally awesome.
Yeah. I just think about that, like both sides of that, you know, from Lahaina to Red Hill, but in the sense of like, and the educational part, but so much of that in your advocacy was, it's reminded me, I was reading about, you know, it's not only training people to be leaders, but to train people to keep leaders in check, you know?
Yep.
And so what a cool role model for them to kind of see, okay, this is how you actually, you know, we have to hold people to account.
Yep.
But also thinking how clearly the language connects everyone to land, right? Like that is, it's rooted in this place. So, and so, I mean, I can imagine that jump was pretty simple for you. I mean,
everything, honestly, like you guys know, so there's a statistician tucked deeply in me. And so everything is probability.
Right.
Is that if you want children, all of us, to be able to give us the greatest probability of understanding how the kupuna lasted here for millennia without doing what we did.
Right.
Then it would behoove us to learn their language, because if language is connected to thought and thoughts shape our actions, then that's the triad to actually rebuild.
Yeah.
You know, the homeostatic nature paradise of Hawaii.
Right.
I mean, you can't call something paradise and you killed it.
Yeah.
No.
You know?
Yeah.
Took it over because you saw its value, but you took it over and squeezed it of everything it's got. Defecated in the front yard, and, and I was like, oh, we don't need it anymore.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, land care is so much, it's just, it's a function of people care, right? I mean, like, it's, if you create a society that cares for the people, by extension, you'll get that. And I'm trying to, like, all the students especially, but folks that are in the land care side or doing conservation or whatever, I'm always trying to, like, you know what, where you really need to start down on the Waukanaka, like, that's really, we need to start taking care of folks. And that, our ability to do that, really would ever, or maybe reverse it, our inability, because I think a lot of that work is underfunded, you know, it's a reflection of the other problems that we sort of fail to deal with socially, right?
But what you guys are doing is really important. Like that's actually where the rubber is going to meet the road. You know, the skills that it took to build the atom bomb are still valuable skills. You just shouldn't have built the bomb.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that's kind of that knowledge mantra that I try to share. Is like you guys have part of the ticket, you know, not just the way out, but you guys understand deeply the whys of the systems that are in place.
Yeah.
You know, and that can not only help maintain structure, but rebuild and sustain.
Yeah.
And, you know, for me, that's the bigger part of, you know, really understanding culture and walking through it authentically.
Mm-hmm.
Is because, and we've kind of hit this, but when you embrace those thoughts, those behaviors, when you walk through them, you just kind of blindly walk through what they did, you already have the data.
Mm-hmm.
The probability is going to be higher.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we're talking statistics right now. Probability speaking, if we all collectively walk this walk, we're going to have way less impact than here.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that's naive. I know it's simple. I know people are gonna be like, "Well, that's not, you know, you're not even including the economy. You're not even including the societal structures in place." And I'm like, "I'm not. I'm just telling you why I'm a proponent of this."
I would argue against them, by the way. I think you are. I think you are. Well, because that way we'll let them rethink what the economy should look like. Yes. I mean, that would be my argument. Yeah. Like what
but
you're saying.
But if you take everybody and shove them this side, it'll inherently change.
Mm-hmm.
It'll automatically change, but I know that's potentially unrealistic. But I hear what you're saying. That's
no, like I say, 100%. Like if you just like you start viewing the resources, whatever you want to call it, the land differently. Like that break needs to happen, honestly, for us to like reimagine what an economic system, society, the benefits, like what we value, what we're willing to like quote unquote pay for is worth, right? And I 100% think that it's like you start placing life above all else. Just like you said, your plant friends and your animal peoples and the whale people and everything.
In a book that I read, it talked about this idea of vision versus programming. And I, oh my gosh, I'll get the name of the book. I think that's Daniel Quinn. But what he kind of talked about is this idea that you have to change the vision and not the programming. You know, like, and a great example would be recycling. Recycling only exists on a particular vision strand. The indigenous people didn't have to recycle. You know, that everything was naturally made in the way to sustain, like, they wouldn't have decided to move outside of that.
Yeah, your economy is already vision, circular.
Because the vision's already there. So the programming was already running in accordance to the vision. You didn't really, you didn't have to fix anything. Where, you know, now here on this vision, there's so many problems taking place on the vision board that the programming, there's all kinds of mitigation strategies pointing to problems.
Yeah. I have a question then. Is it that it's the wrong vision or there is no vision?
Well, I think it's a vision. I think there's a vision because we all enact.
So it's something.
Like us, China, India, all the European nations, we're all enacting the same culture. And that's the vision. Like we all believe we're all there. Like and it starts from like. Sorry, man. I mean, I don't even.
No, you guys can go there because I think you're gonna go to exactly the same place.
I mean, it's gonna start from like religious text. And I always hesitate to say. I mean, I shouldn't hesitate because I should be, you know. Truthful with that, but I think it's like when we believe the things that these religious texts teach us to believe, that we actually own, you know, like dominion.
Have dominion over,
property.
And I think like, you know, Buddhism, the Quran, the Bible, I think it's good when you think about the inner workings of a human. But there's not much there telling you how you belong and tethered to the natural world.
That's it.
Other than the world was made for you to rule.
Right.
And that's ordained by God. And I was like, damn, that's a, you know, I had that message. And when I read it, something that talked about the contrary, I was like, holy cow, that's like every belief that I carry has to be reshaped and restructured because those mantras are so deeply embedded in us. And it's not even about the Bible, you know what I mean? Chinese are doing it. Like we're doing it.
And
it includes war and includes like annihilating populations. It includes ignoring extinction. You know,
it's totally. I know there's like this author I haven't read him for so long. Tom Robbins. He's like hilarious, but he has like this a recurring theme in his books are like that we made this fundamental mistake when we switched from like, you know, matriarchal religions to patriarchal religions. The mistake was when we chose Yahweh, you know, like through like offending people, but like, you know, like, also when we put a dude in charge, like that was that's where everything went sour, you know.
Statistics, men been in charge quite a while, and
we haven't
been doing well. So, I mean, there's something to say about that.
Well, and speaking of like Hawaiian values, so we often ask, you know, cultural practitioners like Hannah Springer, for example, we just talked with her, you know, and she comes from, you know, Aloha Ke Kahi Ke Kahi. That's hers. You know, I wonder if, is there, I know it's so hard maybe to choose one or two or even 10, but is there, and you've talked about so many values that inform your civic engagement, your belief. Is there anything in particular that, you know, you cherish when you're thinking through, like, okay, this is how we approach this really hard problem, or you tell your students, or?
And so one, we're starting off at the school teaching, it's called E-A-I-I-Ke-Kahi-E-Ka-Pi-Ke-Kahi. So it has, you know, these multiple figure literal meanings, but what it comes from is that when you go fishing, you pull up your net, E-A-I-I-Ke-Kahi, eat some, E-Ka-Pi-Ke-Kahi. Some people say it's to salt some, dry it, and save for later. But there's also the idea of kapi is that there's so many fish in the net that kapi is like to sprinkle salt, like to sprinkle things. Like you can kapi leaves, you can kapi is the word for sprinkle. But you have so many fish that you copy the fish back into the ocean.
Yeah.
That you sprinkle the fish back into the ocean. You never take more than you need.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I always use that because beyond that, I don't know, you know, where else to go fundamentally.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can think about don't take more than you need from a person.
Right.
And not physically, like don't drain them emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, be a source of peace or a source of support and strength for them. Only take what you need.
Yeah,
you know, and that's like from land or anything.
No, that's so powerful because I'm reading Robin Wall Kimmerer's book, Braiding Sweetgrass, first time. Finally, and I'm in the middle of a section called The Honorable Harvest,
mm-hmm.
and the values about what the harvest might mean. And there are many, many different ones, and many are unstated, but one value is don't take the first and don't take the last of the harvest, for example. It falls right in there.
And that would be Hawaiian because the first one goes to the altar.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, you take kalo, I mean, you cut the kalo, it goes right back into the land anyway.
Yeah, like a perpetuation. We were talking about that with farmers. It's just like, how long do you think, how many generations is that cycled through? Mm-hmm. It's incredible to think about.
Well, you know, Robin Kimmerer, we talked about the pecan tree, the pecan tree, and the interconnectedness. They all talk to each other and don't fruit one year and then... Mm-hmm. You know, like they utilize those words, like they're talking to each other, but they're all, you know, reacting to the same stimuli. But it's like a language.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, the deeper they go with the science, they're actually all connected.
They're talking.
Bacterial networks, fungal networks.
Yeah. But that's what I think, like in the indigenous space, we don't utilize those terms, but they knew it was there.
Exactly.
And they called it akua. Mm-hmm. You know, they called that.
Yeah, of course.
And to live in that way, it doesn't have to be more complex, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's good to understand it, but it doesn't have to be more complex than that.
I have to ask you a selfish question because this is like a research thing for me because I'm doing an art project in which the art project theme is Aloha No.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the folks has tried to define it for us, but there's many different aloha. I don't have to tell you that. Can you tell me what that might mean for you?
Well, just that no to me is going to symbolize that you're not alone.
Mm.
You know, like aloha is, you generally wouldn't greet someone, oh, aloha no. You know, you're not going to be scolded for it. I mean, if you say, oh, aloha no kawa, I mean, you can do that. But generally, it would be like aloha mai, aloha kawa, pe oi, aloha mai kawa. And they're, oh, aloha no. You know, that the aloha no, that the no is generally in a response and not in the initial call.
Oh, interesting.
And so, like, no signifies to me partnership. It signifies duality, multiplicity. It signifies more like it's not a singular event. It's not a singular thing. I'm just kind of digging into the grammar of it.
I love it. It's a response.
It's a response.
It's not the initial. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really powerful.
I mean, and that no will travel across multiple verbs. So So you know, but oh, should I give this to Clay? That the no will be like, yes, give it to him. It's a confirmation. It's a response.
Yeah.
I love that. That's beautiful. That's one I hadn't heard before.
Like you're going to, it's always this, you know, and there's multiple rules to the, you know, to the usage, but I'm just telling you generally for myself that whenever there's a no, I don't lead off with it.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It would be in response to someone saying something
almost
to you.
Clarification kind, you know?
Yeah.
Did you do something? Yeah, I did that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
Wahana Nova.
I love it. I love it. Well, and in the context of this particular theme for this art show project, you know, it's a reclamation of the word aloha. Okay, it's been so misused, abused. Aloha massage, aloha chiropractic, whatever.
Aloha poke in like Tucson, Arizona.
Yeah, that sort of thing. So this is really a radical reclaiming of.
I think aloha no too could be a part of like a, because it's also a response, like almost a too bad. So, you know, play with that one too. Yeah, like somebody goes, oh, yeah, my grandfather passed away. Ah, aloha no.
A lament, maybe.
And it could be a response. I mean, a response to loss, or a response like a there's an aspect of grief to it.
And so you would give that. mm-hmm. as a response.
Yeah, aloha no is the
modifier. Yeah.
Aloha no, aloha ino maybe. Mm-hmm. Aloha ino, aloha no.
Like deepens mm-hmm. it, but also yep. with you, kind of. Mm-hmm.
Oh, that is really beautiful.
Yeah.
But do you have anything,
No, I
Clay?
Went way over it. I literally wrote down like two questions and then the rest was, you know, off the cuff. But yeah. Uh-huh.
No.
It's been an amazing conversation, Dr. Krug. I don't know if there's anything else you'd like to tell our folks. We have people listening from all over the world, many conservationists. I'm, you know, I would say not a long-term admirer, shorter term. We met on social media, but I've loved all the things that you're doing, especially the music, the mele are like incredible. It's so beautiful, so beautiful. So, by the way, where can we hear you play?
Yeah.
If you want to plug some of your gigs.
Yes, I play with a group called Hi'ikua. And so we play at the Chart House in Waikiki every Tuesday, 6:30 to 9:30. And then every other Thursday in Kane'ohe at East Side Grill.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, and that's going to 7 to 9. 7 to
Do you
9.
Ever go outside the islands and play...
Yeah,
on the
off
continent
and on,
or
off and on,
a little bit.
We just came from a concert in Redondo Beach, kind of last month. Yeah, quite busy, so gotta be selective.
Yeah, you're two jobs, three maybe.
Well, I don't want to call those jobs.
Well,
those are fun, but
like,
they do get paid.
Endeavors.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, thank you guys for the opportunity to talk with you, and you know, I mean, I think for the listenership out there is there's still a lot. I think in the realm of indigenous philosophy and worldview, there's still a lot to rediscover. And, you know, if we can question the idea of progress and that forward equals progress, if we can kind of question that, I think, like, sometimes moving forward is looking back.
Hmm.
And I know we've been taught not to, you know, and that, nope. Keep looking forward. Don't even, sometimes we can't fathom that the answers may be locked in cultures that we've relegated to alcoholism and negative health statistics. And so empowering those communities could mean, and there's high probability, it, you know, with the data that we have, that they hold a potential golden ticket. And so empowering them, helping them, not disregarding them as something from antiquity, but actually acknowledging them as potential progress. I think that'll be a final thought.
God, amen to that.
Yeah. That's a beautiful way
to
end.
Back to church.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
Oh, mahalo nui loa.
Mahalo ya'ulua.
Yeah, thanks so much.